Thank you very much. I'm very grateful to be here, and thank you, the organizers, for this mini program. So my talk it has two parts, actually. So first of all, I'll just give a small overview of the work we've been doing over the last few years on iron-based superconductors. And in the second part, I'll refer to our recent measurements on iron selenium, both ARPAs and quantum oscillation. So this is the list of my collaborator. I'd like to acknowledge my student, Matthew Watson, who's done a lot of work on the ARPAs on iron selenium. Over the years, we collaborated closely with a group of Professor Carrington in Bristol, where I was previously. And samples were grown both in Oxford, in Japan, in Stanford, and recently also in Karlsruhe. Experiments, we perform high magnetic field facilities. Often we go to Nijmegen and Toulouse, and sometimes in Tallahassee, the hybrid magnet. As you all know, there are lots of families of iron-based superconductors, but the ones I'll be talking today are actually, briefly, are these four classes. So they are the 111, the iron selenium, 1111, lithium iron arsenide, part of the 122 series, and a material part of 111 series. So this is a generic phase diagram for isoelectronic peptides. So as different from the usual doping effects that you see in the phase diagram, here I just wanted to plot what happens when we make very small alteration to the chemical structure of this material. So for example, here we have lithium iron arsenide. We replace arsenic with phosphorus, and we get a TC here of 18 Kelvin, whereas in the case of phosphorus, we get only about 4 Kelvin. And if we look at the electronic structure of two materials, they look very similar, so hardly any differences between them, but we still get this very large change in TC. And the isoelectronic systems are somehow a cleaner way to tune interaction, because here we don't do doping, we just make small alteration in their chemical and tiny in the electronic structure. So we can play with the bandwidth, with the Hund-Sruck coupling, and obviously the chemical pressure. And similarly, in other classes of compounds, we find similar effects. So different materials, this is 111, so we have the usual five bands, three hole bands usually in the center of the Brillouin zone, two electron bands on the corner, and the position of this inner hole band sometimes vary from one compound to another, but this is the major change. In the 1-1-1-2-2 compounds, if you go from arsenium to phosphorus, so the barium ion arsenide is right here, becomes antiferromagnetic, whereas the phosphorus is right on the right side and it's a good metal. And as you notice, the difference in band structure is just the degree of warping of this hole band, whereas the electron bands seem to be unchanged. So as we all will discuss more, the electronic structure is relevant both to try to work out if the nesting plays a role in the stabilizing the antiferromagnetic states, but also in establishing what kind of superconductivity and the gap symmetry of in all these materials. So experimentally, we try to access the electronic state using quantum oscillation. This is a well-established method over 50 years and more, in which you place a metal in magnetic field, you quantize the lambda level, and then you have oscillations in the density of states. And if you measure a quantity, a thermodynamic quantity or transfer quantity magnetization here, you see lots of oscillations as function of magnetic field, which are periodic in 1/b. And the information that we extract from here is the frequency of these oscillations, which is directly related to the cross-section areas normal to apply magnetic field. So in this picture, if the area varies along this direction, then you'll pick up two different frequencies. From quantum oscillations, we can also get more information, not only the shape of the Fermi surface and the size of it, but also about information about the quasi-particle. So from the temperature dependence of how the amplitude of these oscillations drop due to the Fermi-Dirac distribution smearing, you get the effect in masses and effects of the impurity caused Landau level broadening, so we can get information about impurity scattering and also spin splitting and somehow also about the vortex lattice if we can measure also in the superconducting state. If I recall correct, it's some paper by Minev, but I need to find it. I don't remember where. So usually all these measurements are done in the normal state, so we suppress superconductivity, so very rarely we manage to really get this information. So now about the effect of correlations, how this is extracted. So what we measure in experiments is the effective mass, but this is normalized both about the anionic lattice potential and by the electron-electron interaction. So it's very important to remember these things because we need to know also the electron-phonon coupling in order to be able to say precisely how strong the electronic correlation are when we extract the effective mass from quantum oscillations. Now, as compared with ARPES, quantum oscillation suffers from limitation in which we can do this experiment. So first of all, we need extremely clean samples. So the mean free path should be at least 150 angstrom or longer. Any amount of disorders, obviously, especially in panic tides, with the effect of the doping, increases impurity scattering. So we've been focusing on the N-member compounds of different series, and we found that if the disorder is not in the ion plane, then somehow, like in the isoelectronic substituted system, then it's much easier to see quantum oscillation than in any other cases. So this is because the amplitude of these oscillations is directly depending on how much impurity scattering there is, so linked to the mean free path exponentially. So how do we do measurements? In these new materials, we've been very fortunate that we have sensitive enough tools to measure tiny little crystals. So here I have a crystal of about 100 micron by 50 micron, which we can place on an AFM piezo cantilever, and we measure torque. And all the setup, it's 2 millimeter long, it's placed into a inside of a bore of a magnetic field, and we can do experiments at very low temperature in very high magnetic fields, and we can rotate as function of the sample in relation to the magnetic field.
Are the cantilevers piezo-resistant?
Yes. Yes. There are also capacitive levers, but these levers require usually much bigger samples. So this allows us to measure tiny little crystals, which they have a sensitivity of about 10 to the minus 12 EMU. This is three orders of magnitude better than a squid. So they are pretty good.
Now how does it compare with the capacitive levers?
I think it's probably, again, three orders of magnitude, probably less sensitivity. And you require bigger samples.
You were saying it's 10 to the power 3 better.
Yes.
Yes.
The piezo. Yeah, I mean, these are similar to the ones used in AFM, so they are.
I can imagine it, yeah. Good. It's a trend for modern wave tuning.
Yeah. So the first material I'll talk about briefly is the lanthanum ion phosphorus oxygen. And in all this system I will mention on ion based superconductors, I'll refer mainly to the effects that we see from quantum oscillations, in particular Fermi surface shrinking and the effect of correlations. So lanthanum ion phosphorus oxygen, it's a low TC superconductor. It's one of the first discovered in this family of compounds, and it's been found to have the superfluid density is linear as function of temperature, so it's been suggested that this is a nodal superconductor. In torque, this is torque as function of magnetic field. So when you measure, you have a background due to the paramagnetism of the sample, and then on top of that, you see oscillatory signal which comes from the Fermi surface. And this is the signal we are interested in, and we subtract this background, we get the oscillatory signal, and then we Fourier transform to get the exact frequencies of these oscillations. In this example, you can see that we also detect information about the AC2 as function of angle, so you can get the anisotropy from this type of measurement as well.
So why is the diamagnetic signal of the blue line so small? I mean, it's a conductor.
Because it's anisotropic. So this is 31 degrees away from the perpendicular to the normal plane, and this is right close to the plane. So it varies strongly with the angle.
Right, so I shouldn't worry about, I would expect sort of a very big Meissner effect, right? Because you look at diamagnetism.
Yeah.
And then you say that
this is it.
Something,
so when you are away from, when magnetic field is in the plane, this is where the largest irreversibility field is, because you don't have the orbital effects to kill the superconductivity.
Yeah, no, yeah, and the sensitivity also goes to zero field.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. Torque is zero field, yeah. So it's not like the magnetization, it's...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. How HC2 was determined on a blue curve? Is there?
You look carefully, and you, usually, usually you do up and down sweeps, and often they are separated. In this case, because the system is very clean, we don't see this strong hysteresis, so it goes on top of each other. But there is a little kink.
So you're saying that the torque is not proportional to magnetization, especially at low fields. Is that correct?
It's magnetization times magnetic field. So it's a product between magnetization.
Okay. So it is magnetization.
It's related to magnetization, yes.
Well, anisotropic component.
Yes, to anisotropic component. So yeah, another thing to mention, if the Fermi surface will be isotropic, will not pick up any signal from that Fermi surface, because there is a term over here, df by d theta. So if this is zero, then for spherical Fermi surface, there will be no torque. So that tells us that the Fermi surfaces that we see are anisotropic as well.
So even though magnetization would, of course, be minus zero, the same the torque measurement would just not be able to detect.
I'm talking now about, yeah, the oscillatory part, yeah.
Well, if I have a sphere, whichever way I rotate, basically the magnetization will adjust to the field, and that's the point.
Yeah.
There are no very easy access from that point of view. Is that an argument, basically?
Yeah, it's the variation of frequency areas with the angle. You have to have a variation, otherwise you don't pick up the same. Okay, so so we see all this frequency, we go in high magnetic field and we pick up extra frequencies, and in a multi-band system we really need a band structure to help us to work out where they come from, because quantum oscillation does not tell you where in the k-space you pick up these frequencies, just that they are there. So this is how we try to work things out. Because we know they are quasi two-dimensional system, we plot f cos theta versus theta. So this tells you how a two-dimensional cylinder area varies as function of angle. And if it's perfectly cylinder, then you expect a flat line, like in the case of this cylinder here, alpha 1, alpha 2. Whereas for a cylinder which is corrugated, then you have a minimum and maximum which vary in an opposite way, because the area for one decreases, whereas the area for the other one increases as you rotate the magnetic field. At a particular orientation, you get an interference effect, which is linked to the corrugation, and this is called Yamagi angle. That's how we work out what is the shape of the Fermi surfaces we see in quantum oscillations. And here we also need the band structure now to assign them to the different the Fermi surfaces, and the dotted line here are the calculate, sorry, the these are the calculation, the solid line on this side, and the dots are the experimental data. And if we look carefully, the way we how we identify is looking at the shape of this dispersion rather than the exact size. So if we are interested to observe a kind of quasi three-dimensional pocket, we should have dispersions all the way to 90 degrees. And this is something we don't see in the data. So we know this pocket is not there. If we look at this very quasi two-dimensional cylinder, then this is the dispersion, very weak splitting in frequencies which go together and they have similar masses. That means that this data originate from this band, which is the most two-dimensional in calculation. And similarly, we see that this dispersion, which we observe for beta 1 and beta 2, is likely to come from this type of cylinder. And then we shift this bands to match to our experimental data. And the way these shifts are made, it's rather unconventional, in the sense it's done individually. So some of the bands, the whole bands are shifted up, whereas the electron bands are shifted down. That means the whole Fermi surface is shrunk. And we often have to check that we don't dope the system by doing the shift.
When I say shifted compared to what, LDA?
To LDA, just LDA. So these are just simple LDA calculations, which are very close to experiments, so especially in this material.
That's what Stephen said, that you just adjust the chemical potential, you get it right, starting from the principle.
Yes,
okay.
Yeah.
Are those relative shifts similar to what Borisenko sees from photometry?
Possibly. I'll show some ARPES data later. But this is something there's been, especially in this compound, there is a disagreement between ARPES and quantum oscillations, because we think there is a oxygen layer there which affects the doping.
So negative shift in energy means what, in the light number?
In all cases, everything gets smaller. Both the holes and both the electron bands get smaller. I mean, this is.
There is a function of atom symbols down in the.
So what I mean is that, okay, I don't have that picture here, but this is, everything gets smaller. All the areas become smaller. That's what I mean. So imagine that if you have a.
Well, if they hold that band shift up, if they hold that shift down.
Yeah, if I take the parabola and shift it down, the cross section becomes bigger.
Now, if you, no, but you shift up, the electrons go up, the holes go down. Yeah. So you shift differently.
How you shift differently?
It's just how you have to shift in this particular.
Yes, that's how you have to shift from the experimentalist point of view, okay? Now we have some theorists which are trying to explain if this shift makes sense.
Can I ask another question? So in a quantum oscillation, of these neckties, do all the groups agree on assignment?
The bands?
Of the bands.
I think we are the only one who done this experiment on this material.
The question was
yes.
Okay, so actually this kind of shift of the electron bands up and hole bands down has been actually suggested to be this caused by interband coupling. And in this paper, it's been suggested there could be an evidence that there's a strong scattering between the electron and hole bands. So it's evidence for nesting.
And this is like Greenfield argument.
Yes, I suppose. So this is
this
is their paper, which obviously I'm not trying to explain to you because I might get you all wrong. But essentially, they think that if this interband coupling is increased, it can explain that both electron and hole bands are shrunk. And this is their picture. So the dotted line is the calculated bands, and this is after you put interaction, everything shifts in the opposite way.
Can you tell that this is a repulsive or attractive interaction? I guess it's repulsive, right?
What was your question?
Whether it's repulsive or attractive interaction. My intuition would say repulsive.
All these are positive.
Yes, that's my next information, which makes sense.
Okay. All right, and another reference to a theoretical paper where I found this mention in 2009 was in this paper in which they suggested that antifragmentary electronic correlation also can cause shrinking of all the pockets or Fermi surface distortion. And yeah, I'll move on now. Another Kolmogorov instability.
So this is
magnetic.
On some
of the news channel. Okay, I'll move on now to the other things. Okay? We can come back to this later. But okay, I will skip now this part, but essentially similar effects have been observed in comparing lithium-ion phosphorus, lithium-ion arsenide. In this case, the electron band seems to be more robust, but there is a change in the hole bands only. And this has been, in this paper, suggested, again, the electronic correlation in lithium-ion arsenide seem to have a slightly different effect in the sense they keep the electron bands unchanged. These are LDA, this is LDA plus DMFT. Whereas the hole bands, the inner one shrink, whereas the outer one expand. Okay, and the third case is the case of the barium ion arsenide phosphorus series. Here we start from the metallic side and we went towards the largest TC. This is because the quantum oscillations were observed from that side. And this is the experiment. You see two electronic bands which shift to smaller value as function of substitution. The electronic bands in this system should be constant, so we shouldn't expect any variation. And these are the calculation here. For the electronic bands, they should be quite flat, but in experiments you see a shrinking of both of them and also any strong increase in the effective mass for these bands, which has been, you heard before, been suggested that in this case you might have a quantum critical point playing a role. But again, the antiferromagnetic fluctuations are increasing as we approach the maximum TC. Okay, and this is how we extract masses in quantum oscillations. We look at the amplitude versus temperature, and we find that in the case of lithium-ion arsenide, which has a TC of 18 Kelvin, the mass is much higher than in the last four compounds. And if I put everything on this famous plot, indeed the values that we extract from our quantum oscillations are very close to what has been predicted by DMFT for the different series of compounds. But if we look in the same series of compounds where we can finely tune the interaction by the isoelectronic substitution, that there seems to be some correlation between the TC and the strength of correlation. So I'm talking about the same series where there are tiny adjustments in the shapes of different surfaces. So that we could extract for the series.
You don't see that this is really about this sort of the effect that you discussed first, that electron hole pockets.
Unfortunately, in this case, we can only see electrons, and that makes it harder to make a conclusion about the hole bands. It's just the impurity scattering.
How do you extract lambda from one?
So this is from the effective mass. So we measure the effective mass. As I mentioned, we need to know the electron phonon coupling, which is assumed to be about 0.25. And that's how we extract the electron-electron coupling.
I see. So for the purpose of this plot, it's a constant shift.
Yes.
So from compound to compound, lambda from formula doesn't change.
There are small changes, though. But I think they're probably within a similar range.
So it's theoretical.
Yes, theoretical. This is a theoretical value. It's not a measure value.
That's taken from LDAs.
Yes. It's not a measure value. And okay. So I'll move on now to the second part of my talk, which is it's on the bulk ion selenium. And I'll present both some ARPAS results and quantum oscillations. you know, the motivation for why we are all interested in this material is been suggested that it could be a high TC superconductor if it's made in a monolayer form on SPO. The Fermi surface of this, the monolayer system doesn't seem to have hole bands, and under pressure, it's believed that the superconductivity is strongly enhanced and it's in the proximity of other magnetic phases. So this year, it's been a breakthrough in the sample qualities of these materials, and these are samples that we also try to make, and we succeeded. So the crystal quality is very high. These are measurements of in-plane conductivity. This is the interplane conductivity. There is a small hump in the interplane, possibly due to some incoherent transport at high temperature. And this is an X-ray to show the beautiful, perfect pattern. And this is torque measurements as a function of magnetic field, which just tells you the variation of the